Well, here we go. Good morning, everybody. Hopefully our stream looks good and you're having a great morning. I'm thankful that folks can join in and listen in a couple of formats. I want to do an introduction of Jared in just a second, but to indicate everybody that's listening in, we've got some folks who are listening into the audio on Zoom. We've got some folks on Twitter, some folks on YouTube, a couple different Facebook sites, anywhere else I could possibly put it. The countdown timer we were using was supposed to scooch forward a little bit, but apparently, like many things in life, as Edwin says, we're supposed to be a meditation on God, so doing Jabin before Israel. And that's correct, Edwin. That's exactly what you should be doing. Jared, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. I right before our spring break started getting sick. And so every time we're doing this whole thing of, is it a cough or is it COVID? You know, so that's always an exciting sort of a time. But no, doing great here. You know, I teach at Florida College, and we've just now switched to doing things entirely online. So I've had to very quickly become a, I won't say a streaming expert, but welcome. At least something.
Yeah, welcome to the land of something. I will not claim expertise, but I will claim painful experience. And so there's challenges there. A couple things in the course of this study, and especially today as we introduce things, if you have questions, please drop them in the comments. Everyone should be able to see them. If you're just listening in, we'll be able to read those for everybody. And hopefully that will improve our interaction and the value of the study. A couple other things. What Jared and I are going to be doing is we're going to kind of, for those who are part of the Eastside congregation who maybe have been part of our Judges study that we were doing there, we're having to restart a little bit. We feel like it's probably the best thing to do with the two of us working together to teach it. Plus, there is obviously a number of folks joining in who are not part of those studies. And so for today, Jared and I are going to introduce the text of Judges. I'm going to try to cover some of the narrative elements, give it some context, maybe define some terms, bring some perspective to the text that is really important if you're curious or want to know why God moved and acted certain ways, both from Genesis forward, but also from Judges all the way through the Kings and into captivity. Understand that there's a lot of terminology that we're familiar with over the years of our Bible studies that we use in different ways. And I'll use one quick illustration of it. It's the term dispensation. Jared and I have talked about that a couple times recently. And that's a word that's kind of theologically loaded. If you talk to some who are thinking in terms of end of the universe theology, dispensationalism is a theological structure. Years ago, 20, 30 years ago, it was more of a used amongst the Christians I know. It's more of a kind of a time frame terminology. And so whenever possible, when Jared and I encounter words that we use those ways, or maybe we know some folks have used it different ways, we're going to re-explain ourselves a couple of times to try to explain the story that God is telling us. And as a stepping point, let's begin by talking about where does the text of Judges fit in the story of God and the story of Israel? As it connects to Joshua, as it connects to everything that happens after Judges, and the bigger, big thing, which is showing us who God is and teaching us more specifically what God is doing. Because in Judges, there's a lot of God telling us things that we need to know, especially if we're not very familiar with the story of God. Jared, you can interject all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we'll bring some stuff up. We've got some fancy widgets to show and some charts and things like that. But let's kind of review Genesis to Joshua real quick. I think that's probably a quick thing to do. There's a couple of cycles of stories that take place. We're not going to go into great detail. Let's just tell the story. Jerry, what's the story of Genesis? We'll go from Genesis, and then we'll go Exodus, and then we'll go Judges, kind of as
yeah. So Genesis, to borrow a phrase that became the title for my cousin's notes on Genesis, it's really about the growth of the seed. You've got these two, you know, very broad narratives, Genesis 1 through 11 and then Genesis 12 through 50, where it's talking about God's created the world as good. And yet, even though God creates the world as good, man messes it up. And then God has to recreate it, and he messes it up again. And we get this cycle going on a few different times, you know, with creation and then the fall, with the flood and then the events right after the flood, and then kind of highlighted again with the Tower of Babel. And then finally you're saying, well, how's God going to do this thing? How's God going to redeem his creation and his people? And we see then at that time we have this character Abraham who's introduced. And Abraham is given these promises, and one of these promises is he's going to have a seed that is going to save all of people, all the people. And yet Abraham, just like everybody else in the narrative and just like the rest of the people, is also a sinner, and he has these moments of really incredible faith and moments of just boneheaded idiocy, right? The very same chapter in 12 where God's like, hey, leave your whole people and come and have trust in me and I'll give you blessings. And Abraham's like, sure thing, is the same chapter. He's like, oh no, I'm hungry. I better go to Egypt. That's going to be great. Also, Sarah, say you're my sister.
Yeah.
And this kind of back and forth is the same thing. And yet God is faithful and God is going to redeem his people. And the faithlessness of his people is not going to invalidate his own faithfulness. And that's really the story of Genesis. God's faith counterpointed with the faithlessness even of these wonderful heroes that we think of when we read the story of Genesis.
Yeah.
What about Exodus?
So Exodus is kind of the there's just so much beautiful picturing of God's interactions with mankind in Genesis or in Exodus. So we've got the seed of Israel captured in the chamber of Egypt. And it's both kind of a safe spot, but it's also a refining fire. And so there's some cycles of interaction that take place in the text there that teach us a whole lot about what God can and will be doing with us. We start with, let's just start like kind of with second phase Moses. Not baby Moses, but the next step of him, like before he's going to flee Egypt. Arrogant, prideful, the statements that are made by the Israelites to him, are you now to judge us, are pretty accurate about him because of his...
Or they're accurate about the Israelites.
Well, hey, probably both. You know, there's a lot of depth there. And so he goes off, he comes back, and then we have the conflict of the unseen and the seen that takes place in the courtroom of the Pharaoh. And most folks are familiar with the how the plagues combat the general theology of Egypt. That's a pretty familiar thing. But the last thing I want to think about is something that sets the stage for the Canaanite conquest. When Moses asks Pharaoh, please let us go and offer sacrifices in the wilderness, he's essentially saying, can we go make sacrifice at the door of your God? Can we take all of Israel out into where the doorway for your God rises in the morning every day and go out there? And it's obvious that the Pharaoh said, no way, you're not going out there. That's holy space to us. Further, you are our slaves. And so this stretching dynamic takes place all the way through the Exodus storytelling phase, where you have these powerful steps of God continuing to show his dominance over the divine realm, the unseen realm, while Israel fusses, fumes, and does what Israel always accomplishes. Let's take a few idols, put them in our back pocket, and take them with us for the journey. And so they keep doing that all the way into the big pictures of the presence of God at the Mount, and Israel saying, well, we can't be that close to God, but we'd be kind of close to God, even in the fire and cloud phases of their journey, all the way up into the final preparations where we're going to go take the land. And then we have Joshua, we have Caleb who come back with these positive, we can do it, we can do it. And everyone else is like, no way, not going to happen. There's Nephilim in the land.
Nephilim,
but Nephilim.
Nickname for you, Nephilim.
Yes,
you are about tall enough.
I'm at the lower edge of the giants. You know, the graceless orangutan has a spot. And so even, you know, each of those steps going forward, you know, you have all of that takes place, and they bounce off the promised land. Like they're run, boink. And then they go back into a new formative phase. Joshua, Caleb, and Moses are the remaining adults, if you will, Moses doesn't go all the way in. I say adults kind of in a very accommodative sense because they act like children sometimes too. And then that brings us into the text of Joshua. The conflict in Joshua, and I don't want to summarize all of that, but they take the strongholds in the north, they take the strongholds in the south. They really wipe out the economic and military structure of Canaan. They do not eradicate everybody by any means, not even accounting for the treaties that they make to create slaves and all of that. But the text says they leave nothing undone. There's a tension in that reality that Judges begins to answer. And so that's like the story of Genesis, Exodus, a little bit of Joshua, and now we're at the edge of Judges chapter 1.
And I think that narratively, so much is based on the final chapter of Joshua, you know, Joshua chapter 24, which everybody and their brother, you know, I always ask when I teach this in my Old Testament history and geography class, which your son was in last semester, you know, how many of y'all's house have one of these like fancy Bible verse passages, you know, as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord, right? And everybody reads, you know, this passage there in Joshua, it's like, oh, look how faithful Israel is. But when you dig a little deeper into that text in Joshua 24, there's it's really pretty condemnatory, and that is that Joshua says, I'm going to serve the Lord, but you guys aren't even doing that now. Y'all serve gods in Egypt, you're going to serve gods in Canaan, y'all are idolaters, and y'all are going to lose this land in the same way, and this whole preparation of conquest is subverted by the last chapter in a similar way as we see in Genesis 1 and 2, and then followed upon immediately by Genesis 3. And it's in that context of Joshua saying, I'm going to serve God, but you guys really aren't, even though you're going to say you are. That's the context for Judges. And it really sets Judges up because Judges takes a lot of the same narratives, as we'll see when we go through the book, that are in Joshua. We have repeats of the same sorts of stories. You know, so if you think about the major narrative stories of Joshua, these major battles that you're talking about, right? Like, what are the major battles that they fight in the book of Joshua?
Well, major battles, they're kind of fall into a couple of categories. They've got the band together nations. They've got the powerful remnant of the Nephilim, which is one of my favorite sections of Joshua. Like, everyone likes the last chapter. I love when Caleb says, you know what? You know those giants up on the hill?
I'm still an old man, but I'm going to take them out anyway.
Yeah, I like that. His whole speech there is like one of those definitive moments. I think I may have said this. I know you've said this too. Joshua as a text is kind of like some of the prophets where you get their highlights. These are the highlights of the worthies of Israel as they take the land. And no one's perfect. And there's some weird sections in the text too where there's some conflict and tension in Joshua. But again, it's mainly focused on the destruction of the primary military entities in Joshua's time frame.
If we're going to say there's three cities that Joshua focuses on destroying, what are those three cities?
Well, we got to get the maps out for that, but give me a second. The cities that you've got, obviously Jericho is
one of them. Jericho is the main one,
you know,
right?
You've got that core.
Right, and then in the north you've got...
Well, hold on. Let my brain... Jared's pushing me on the other side as a teacher to remember everything, where I like to use maps and details. Because I'm thinking of the southern cities, I'm thinking of the five that are banded together, and as Terry Francis pointed out, I conflate names all the time.
Yeah. Well, think a little bigger, darling, to quote the movie Inception.
Hold on, I have not had enough caffeine yet. You've got to go easy on me. give me a second. I'm also doing eight other things.
You can also pull up your map. It'll be fancy.
I'm also doing eight other things while you're trying to do that.
Yeah, so I'll answer
your own questions
for everybody. So Jericho, of course, is the first one that we think about, them coming across there. And then in the north, we have the destruction of either Hazor, if you want to, you know, pronounce it like a English speaker, or Hazor, if you want to be fancy schmancy, you know, in the north, the head of all those kingdoms. And then, of course, we have that special story of the taking of Jerusalem. Well, those three narratives, those three stories, Jericho, Hazor, Hazor, and Jerusalem, the taking of those three cities is going to be repeated in Judges. And just as the book of Joshua begins with a conquest, the book of Judges is going to begin with an anti-conquest. That really what Judges is going to be doing is kind of rolling back and reversing all the progress that they made in Joshua. that at the very beginning we're going to realize, hey, I thought they were going to destroy Jericho and nobody was going to be living there. Well, we're going to find out immediately that this guy named Eglon is in the city of the Palms,
yeah.
Right? Immediately, right at the very beginning of the book, we've got Jericho rebuilt. That we've got a new Jabin, king of Hazor, the same as the old Jabin, king of Hazor, right? And, of course, the book is going to end focused on Jerusalem, which I thought we took. But nope, back in control of the Jebusites.
Right. And a couple other things. You know, we've got all of the spatial representations, everything. And then in addition to that, it's not just about the physical structures. And this is the one thing that I was about to bring up when Jared sidetracked me into the cities and I had to get my brain going.
Sorry about that.
Again. It's fine.
Not sorry.
I'll be hassling Jared throughout the course of this entire study. You're welcome to do so in the comments. I'm going to read some of the comments in a second. There's a theological conflict that takes place in Canaan as well. And Joshua hints at it in his final speech. This is kind of the theology side that I wanted to kind of emphasize too at this point. In Egypt, it was the gods of Egypt. Theological structure of Egypt was in conflict with the whole theological structure of Jehovah, Elohim, Yahweh, and all of that. When you go into the upper regions now of Canaan, when they make their whole way entry into here, all the Canaanite gods are now in play. One of the things that I think is really important to understand about Joshua that leads into Judges is that it's not just an earthly text. It's not just, here are the greatest fighters of Israel fighting the greatest atheists of mankind. These are all theists. They all believe deeply in the sovereign nature of their gods. And so every conflict is framed in that way. You don't have to have a deep understanding of who the other gods are to not to kind of push aside the reality that the Canaanites believed their gods were going to answer their prayers. And that's a separate issue to saying, what level of strength was there for them? We don't have to worry about that. You just have to know that they believed and they acted like it. So when Israel arrives in Canaan and does not squash the religious structure of Canaan, it's a natural byproduct that it seeps back into their lives. And I think that's one of the things that's super important about Joshua 24, is that Joshua says, look, you have a choice. Gods of Egypt, the gods of Canaan, or Elohim. You decide. As for me and my house, we have decided. In essence, is what that story he's telling in his big sermon. And so it shifts off the table of which city, in all the various ways you could name and define the cities and the power structures of the north, the power structures of the south, Shiloh, Shechem, they don't matter anymore, per se. What matters is you left everything undone spiritually. And so that's, I think, a big narrative point. I want to read Edwin Crozier's comment, which he brought in from YouTube. He says, since you asked for comments, regarding Exodus leading up to Judges, I always think about something Exodus does not include. We may see why the enslavement occurs through Ezekiel 23:19. They started a committee. I'm going to read all of those comments. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say Ezekiel 23:19, just in case y'all don't know that. Yet she increased her whoring, remembering the days of her youth when she played the whore of Egypt. Ezekiel 23 is one of these harlotry texts where God is describing the two sisters, Judah and Israel, as harlots. And he's like, hey, let me tell you the history of what you guys did. And here we read there. And just like in Joshua 24, we read that she was serving the gods of Egypt when she was in Egypt, and God still brought her out of Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us.
Edwin thinks they started committing adultery of foreign gods. Also, the great point of Exodus is the end in which the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle. Do we ever see the glory of the Lord in the tabernacle in Judges? The only thing that's glorious in Judges is when you get to close the book. on my perspective, it includes one of the most awful chapters in the Bible. The priesthood story at the end of the text is gut-wrenching to me. I know other folks may have different perspectives.
Yeah. To answer Edwin's specific question, we don't ever see the glory of the Lord fill the tabernacle. The priests are almost always bad in the book of Judges. We do see the spirit of the Lord filling, and it's really not filling. It's a slightly different term. Certain judges, except instead of kind of what we think about the Holy Spirit kind of living in them, it's instead he takes them over and makes them more than who they are. This is going to be a really big thing when we get to the story of everybody's favorite, or a lot of people's favorite judge, Gideon.
Yeah.
God actually takes him over with his spirit. So we'll see that a little bit when we get there. But no, Edwin, we don't ever see anything like that, like in Exodus chapter 40.
It's bad, all bad, and then really bad.
And then it gets worse.
Yeah. So that tells us that it starts off with like, okay, where does it fit in the big structure? Now it gives us kind of a textual introduction into what's going on roughly in the text of Judges. There's a lot. Judges is actually a really great book to teach. If you're a teacher and you love challenging passages, you love challenging texts, you love developing a healthier theology of Jehovah, Judges and Genesis 1, 2, and 3 as kind of compatriot texts are great to do that. Everything always goes back to the garden anyway. So we've got a subtitle that we jokingly have selected for the text of Judges, which is Warlords. Israel becomes Canaan, properly spelled. Let's hope so. Typos are my particular Achilles heel. So Jared, why don't you explain a little bit about why warlords make sense both translation-wise, but also just contextually in the text of Judges?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason this came about is someone was asking about, you know, who counts as a judge in the book of Judges. And the term, the word in Hebrew that we have for the book of Judges is actually not the term we have used throughout the book of the Judges to talk about judges themselves. I mean, when we think in English about the term judge, we think of, you know, guys in black robes, kind of like this, you know, my academic regalia that I'm using to block out the glare from my window. But we think about guys with gavels in a judicial setting. And that is not at all what these guys are, right? These guys, the term that we would in Hebrew or Greek is savior. But these aren't saviors. When we think of savior, we're so enculturated to that idea through our New Testament lens of Jesus as savior. But what savior, or in Greek soter, means in the first century and before then, and what you know, this term in Hebrew for judge or savior means, is it means military victor. It means, you know, think of Greek hero like Achilles and Hector, not necessarily a good person, but a powerful person. These guys are like Japanese shoguns. These guys are warlords. I mean, think about Samson. What does he do that's judging? Nothing. He's a warlord, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, what about your favorite judge, Ehud, right? What does he judge?
Well, he's my second favorite.
Oh, who's your favorite?
Oh, by far, it's Shamgar.
Shamgar. Oh, that's just because of that awesome
It will come up. It will come up. I'm getting the rights for us to use it in the broadcast.
Okay, just wait for it.
Yeah.
But in the meanwhile, look up Nate Creekmore's Shamgar. It's incredible. Yeah. But Ehud, he doesn't judge anybody. What is he? He's an assassin, right? These people are not judges. They're warlords. And when we use that term today, warlords, we have a very negative connotation, don't we?
Yeah.
And
we think Genghis
should.
Khan.
That's what we should think of, right? Yeah. Because these judges, by and large, especially after the first one or two, not good people. And in fact, most of them, terrible people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. How many of you want your daughters to marry any of the judges?
Yeah.
You know, including even the ones that we think emphasize, like, I'm not going to tell Hallie, go find yourself an Ehud. You know, go find yourself a Shamgar. Because there's a lot more going on with who those guys are.
What about Samson or a Gideon? Don't you want her to marry a, you know, an adulterous womanizer or an idolater?
You know, there's more like there's just a lot more depth to who they are than the surface level cardboard cutout VBS take. There's use in that, and I don't want to disparage those who make good use of some of the short stories in Judges. There's a lot of worth there. Edwin asked a question, is deliverer a good word for Judges?
Deliverer is better. It depends on what we mean. We think of deliverer still through the idea of delivering us from sin. Now, if we have instead a military context in mind, perfect, right? You know, translation, as Edwin knows, because he's taken a lot of Greek, is absolutely a fluid. It's as much art as science. And as long as you get across the fact that these guys are,
I thought you could do it with a computer,
and not spiritual in context, you cannot do translation with a computer. Those in the know exactly what I'm throwing shade at over here. But as long as you have a military context in mind, you'd be good to go. Whatever word you want to use, I'm not picky.
Yeah. And just a side note for translation stuff, generally speaking, most peer-reviewed, and I say like group-studied translations, where there's humans involved, are pretty good.
Any of the modern major committee translations
are pretty
great.
Good. You know, will we complain about a verse or two? Yes, but we're probably wrong. Let's be fair, because we don't know what they knew. Like, there's a reason that they negotiated to this settlement of a translation. And it's probably because the words are obscure, complicated, or there's not a good English way. Show me the money.
Sometimes it's money.
Sometimes it's money. There's usually a good reason. We may not like it. Hal mentioned, you know, I would have named his own son Shamgar was one of his kid name choices. I was going for Malachi, but I got overruled. So that kind of helps us understand what this is, because once you understand the way to understand the terms in the text, it then shifts our picture a little bit. So now we've established a couple of core guidelines of where it fits in the sequence of Israel. History is a fluid, messy kind of thing, and so I'm not really super concerned with times and dates at this point, other than it happened after the Joshua things and before the Samuel things and before the Kings things. It fits in that gap. Probably, for me at least, I would see it as slightly parallel to the Ruth stuff, or just before the Ruth stuff. But they're certainly compatriots in some way or another. And so that kind of gives us a time frame in all of that as well. And so a couple more things to kind of think about in that is, now what lessons are we looking for? There are some questions I like to ask in Bible classes. They're designed to kind of hit across the spectrum of prior knowledge, present knowledge, and future questions. And so I always ask, especially in big group studies, I used to always do this in like coffee house type studies. Now I'm kind of doing it in larger senses. You know, what do you like in the text? Edwin has a question we can get to first before we jump into those. He says, does Matthew 19:28 use judging in the same way when referring to the apostles? Matthew 19:28.
I'm pulling that up right now. I do not have Matthew 19:28 memorized. Sorry, Edwin, if your thoughts of me have been completely destroyed.
For those watching, you can see Matthew 19:28 in the ESV on the stream.
Okay, so to answer Edwin's question, the term, the verbal term that Matthew is using for judge is the word that, you know, most first year Greek students learn for judge is krino. That is different from the term that we have for soter or for savior or judges that we're going to use in the Septuagint text. So it's not exactly the same thing. Those are different words, a little bit different semantic meanings. Happy to get into that more if you want to shoot me a PM about something,
right,
so that I'm not boring everybody with Greek.
One more thing I thought we should do before we get to our other questions, and I just remembered it as I was looking at my little notes. I have a crib notes, which, by the way, also did not include the three cities of note in the Canaanite reason. I'm going to continue to hassle Jared about that from now to antiquity. But I am the visual fella, and so we need to bring this one up. And so this is the ring structure as presented in a number of different commentaries and approaches to the text. This one comes from Kenneth Way's book, which is good. I recommend it. It's a great introduction into the structure of Judges and a good way to teach the text, which
yeah,
I would
series. Just throw in a side note there. Kenneth Way is a acquaintance / friend of mine, and he is actually going through a really hard time right now. He had stage 4 cancer. He's been self-isolating for 6 months. So if, for those of you guys who've been doing this for a week,
he's pro.
Yeah, so he could use your prayers, and him and his family both. He's a great guy, and his book in the Teach the Text Commentary series, really, really good introduction book. It's very, very short, very practical, but it's excellent. I think that it's a model for how to write an introduction commentary. If you're the kind of person who doesn't like commentaries, you'll like this.
Yeah. Let me give a quick visual introduction, and then, Jared, I want you to take a few seconds and just kind of describe the interconnection of these stories. And so this is a two-dimensional representation of something that's actually three-dimensional. And so the way to think about this ring structure is to picture the prologue at the top of the funnel. And as the prologue cycles through the various judges, the funnel, the toilet bowl, the dumpster fire that is judges swirls.
The dumpster fire going down the river.
Right. That swirls downwardly. And so this cyclone of doom and destruction goes from the prologue to the epilogue. And so if you take the picture here, it's this way, and you rotate it to now it's this way, you're actually seeing a funnel that goes downward. So they get tighter and more compressed in their pain and their anguish. But you can't really do that in a book. It's hard to visually represent. But this gives us kind of an idea here that things go winding down, which is a Primus reference from one of the early albums. That's another obscure pop reference for some of our audience.
Very much so. I like it, though. I like it.
That's lean into your strengths. Those are things I'm good at, obscure pop culture. So kind of give us a quick breakdown of the interactions of each of these judges as they reflect one another, as concisely as we can.
Yeah. Let me just do this in just like 2 minutes. So when I first was reading this and I saw Kenneth Way's ring structure, I was like, that's way too complicated. There's no way this is purposeful. And then after I've taught through judges a few different times, once in church setting, twice at the college, this is exactly 100% intentional and right. It works every single time. Let's just look for a second at how this plays out for jumping from the epilogue and the prologue. So that's at the top of this cycle. And that is both the prologue and the epilogue have the same stories in them. Both of them have a story about corporeal dismemberment. So in the beginning, you cut off the thumbs and big toes of a Canaanite king. And at the end, you end up cutting up a Levite's concubine. At the beginning, you have the focus on Jerusalem, where Jerusalem is conquered in chapter 1, verses 7 through 8. And then it's not conquered in chapter 19. Both times, you have a focus on a story on marriage, where you have Othniel and Achsa married in chapter 1. And then in chapter 19, you've got this Levite and the concubine who have functionally divorced. In both cases, you have the story of a wife on a donkey. And you're like, that's a weird little detail. But in the beginning, Achsa brings her own complaint to her father, seeking justice and participation in the world. But in the end of chapter 19, the Levite's concubine is loaded up onto a donkey, dismembered, and serves only the needs of a man. And in the beginning, you have the tribes failing in chapter 1, verse 21, to eliminate all the Jebusites from Jerusalem. And at the end, all the tribes fail to establish justice. In other words, they're the same stories, but it's worse. And it functions in the whole idea that I kind of gave for the subtitle for the warlord's context. And that is, Israel has become Canaan. In fact, now they're worse than Canaan. And the conclusion is, if the book begins with Canaan being destroyed because of their wickedness, well, if Israel's worse than Canaan, what do we know is coming, Phil?
Yeah.
They're going to be destroyed. But the cool thing is those levels work the same way. So if we go to the next level between Samson and Othniel, we also have the same sort of a thing play out here where there's connections between the two points that go back to what's going on. So, for example, these are the two tribes that are in the south, okay? Dan, who at that point in the time of Samson is still in the south, and Othniel for Judah. Both of them have marriage stories. Both of them have Judah portrayed first as positive, then as negative. Both have the story of how Canaanites and Israelites are assimilating. We'll get to this when we talk about Othniel, but most people don't realize he's actually an Edomite and not an Israelite. Mm-hmm. But of course, Samson's an Israelite who wants to become a Philistine. And both of these stories, we have the mention of 40 years. Othniel, 40 years of peace. And Samson, 40 years of oppression. And each time we go down, the same thing is true. Ehud and Shamgar align with Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. Deborah and Barak align with Abimelech, Tola, and Jair. And Gideon is split in the middle as some of the longest narratives. And on the right side of the chart, it's all worse than on the left side. So the idea is the same thing happens, but it's so much worse. And it's a great structure. I think when you're teaching the book, if you pay attention to those things, it really helps make it deeper and appreciate what our inspired author is doing and leading to that inevitable conclusion that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, that Judah is going to be destroyed. They are going to go into exile because of their sins.
So in all of this, we're then presented with one quick thing before we get to our five basic questions that we'll try to use, and then we'll also talk about some lessons to learn in the process of that. This message is not a cobbled together, kind of like a gap story. Like, well, let's put some things together. This is an illustration of inspiration in the Old Testament, that there's a hand involved. And it's not described for us how, but in the texts themselves, they rarely define the methodology of inspiration. Jesus comes in as the capstone. And if you believe in the resurrected Son, you should believe in inspiration. They're kind of hand in hand because Jesus says often the scriptures say, and he refers back to the broad bulk of writings from Genesis to Malachi plus John. You know, the Old Testament text, when Jesus says scriptures, he's talking about that. All the way into the prophet John, who is the last prophet of the Old Testament era, if you will, or time span, or whatever.
However you want to term that, right?
Pick a word is probably close enough to find as you're going to get. And so it's a structured book, and the structure means something just like any other thing. I do this a lot because I love the literary approach to the text. Just like every story you read and every movie you see, it's got beginning, middle, and end. It's got climaxes. It's got resolution. It's got emotional catharsis.
Unless it's a Michael Bay film.
Those are just great explosions. He's kind of synthesized down to like just basically the climax. It just goes straight into the end of the book, 2 seconds in. All of that is taking place there. I think it's important then for us to remind ourselves that God is doing these things for reasons. And so I've got some questions. I'll drop those in the chat. They should kind of drop themselves out there. Those who are part of the East Side congregation will probably be like, oh, we've seen these questions before because he asks these all the time now. And I think they're great additional questions. I can certainly imagine Edwin says, can you imagine Judges as a Michael Bay film? I can imagine Shamgar as a John Wick film, / Matrix.
# Nate Creekmore, yeah. # Shamgar.
Yeah, we'll have pictures soon. We're going to bring him into the major scene. So in Judges, a question to think about is, what did you like? In the story of Judges, when you look back at it, is there good there or is something that you appreciate? Jared, you can ask the question for us real quick. What do you like about Judges? I know you love this is like one of your favorite books to teach.
Yeah, it is. One of my favorite things about Judges, and this is true of all of them, is that if God can use these horrible, awful people, then it means he can use me. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times I'm a pretty horrible and awful person. And that should give us comfort. So much in our kids' Bible class versions and our VBS Bible class versions, we think of that God only uses heroes because we kind of make everybody a hero or everybody a villain. And the unfortunate byproduct of that is, well, if I'm not like a perfect person or a really good person, then God can't use me. And that's not true. God is a perfecter of imperfect people. That God uses broken people to fix his broken world only through the transformative power of his perfect Christ. And so every time I read Judges, that is an encouragement to me that if he can use these people, he can use me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm going to make a statement I think everyone's going to agree to. Right now, the world feels like a dumpster fire. 2020 feels like a dumpster fire to me. Some of the people in the world are behaving like dumpster fires. I think those are important truths to recognize, that that's a truth. And yet, we see good. We see individuals manifesting the glory and kindness of God. Michael West comments, I like when Joshua told his house, told them his house would serve the Lord. He pointed them to them to let them know they needed to choose who they would serve. I need to be reminded I choose every day by my actions who I serve. Whether anybody else knows, the same thing is true for all of us. We're making the same basic thing. Secondly, what questions do you want answered? Like when we look at the text, do we have stuff we don't know? I mean, there's a lot I don't know. I'll bring mine in a second. I'll go first this time. One of the challenges for me is that by what time we get to Ruth, whether you place it at the end of the text of Judges or kind of like as a thread through it, what's going on with Boaz and his people? And Boaz's people is weird in that everybody else is doing the wrong thing. And Boaz and his house and Rahab and the house that begins Boaz's house are all like are converts. They're first generation believers. If you're someone who's interested in evangelism, think about the faith of the new convert versus the faith of the child raised in the house of the Lord. And I'll use some illustrations that way, whether it's in the pew or in someone's home. There's some story there that I want to know what else is going on. Like what happened to produce that outcome in that sense? Jared?
Yeah, so I think that for me, the one that I think about a lot in terms of this question is similar to the way you are thinking about it. So I'm not really different enough, I don't think, in this case, to merit taking up too much more time on that one.
Yeah, Edwin says he wants the answer to the contradictions, by the way, between Joshua and Judges.
Yeah, we'll talk about them as we get to them. Maybe the first place we'll talk about them is when we get to Ehud.
Yeah.
But the short version is this. These two books are a lot like when you read some of the prophets written very similar in that they're serving dramatically different functions based on exactly when they're written. Joshua, at least to kind of tip my hat and provide a little bit of speculation, but there's good reason for it. If you ever want to get into that, I can talk to you about that. Is that Joshua's written during the time of when Josiah is king and showing what will happen if people follow a godly leader. And Judges is written after Josiah dies, and we realize, actually, the people have been terrible the entire time. And so Joshua is written to tell the same story, the same events, from a perspective of what could be. And Judges is written to tell the story of those same events of what's actually going on behind the scenes when the people's character is revealed.
All right. There's some theological truths there. You don't have to worry so much. At least I don't worry about so much when they're written, because that is what they say. You know, the when of the writing is really helpful for understanding the behavior of the Jews about to go into exile. And I say Jews as Israel still remaining. That is pretty obvious. Like they needed to hear that and they needed to know that or react to it. And they're about to go into captivity by the time it gets to Josiah. There's that train has already left the station. And so there's no get around it at that point. What does the text of Judges teach us about people? Because I think this is one of the things that this is a question saying, okay, what do we learn here? I'll tell you from my perspective, people are awful. A person can be great, but people are awful. That's it. Like that's just a general thing for me. And that doesn't change.
For me, I'd say, you know, they need Jesus, right? Yeah. You know, we joke, you need Jesus, but that's true of everybody. You know, I get ragged on a lot because I don't think Joseph is a perfect person. You know, Paul's pretty clear. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. There aren't good people. What there are transformed people. And that's what we all need. And that when we look at Judges, we say, hey, if I don't choose God, if I instead choose myself, choose selfishness, I may start out like the beginning of the epilogue and think, oh, this is this silly story about someone who worships an idol. Oh, that's so silly. That's, you know, we think idolatry is just posh and not funny. But by the end of the story, you realize, okay, a person who starts out worshiping an idol is going to end by dismembering their wife. Right? Yeah. That's what happens. Because if you're selfish and if you decide, you know what, I don't care what God says about this, you can do that to anything.
Yeah.
That we need to completely submit ourselves to God's will. Otherwise, that's who we will become.
So in the text itself, what do these stories teach us about Jesus and God? Kind of like Esther, Jehovah is backseat versus front seat. Although Esther, he is way in the backseat in the text of Esther. Where in Exodus, Jesus and God are more front seat, if you kind of look at the scale of things. But what do we learn about God in this? Because these people don't care about God in Judges, for the most part. Certainly at the end of the book. So, Jared, what do you see there? What are we learning about the divine realm or the unseen realm or God or Jesus? That's a complicated question, right?
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, first you've got your Heiser reference, right? The unseen realm. That's a little something we'll talk about later on.
We'll get there.
Yeah, but I would say that in the specific question of what it is between the interaction of God and man is we will see that God's going to say, oh, I'm never going to save them again. They're not worth saving. But he does.
Yeah.
You know, over and over again, by the end of the book, I mean, the people don't even ever repent. They whine and they complain to God, but God is seeking any possible inkling so that he can save his people. And we also have this idea of God in the Old Testament as this vengeful God. You know, Chris Hitchens is, you know, moral monster. Dawkins is, you know, awful, you know, petty. But you read the book of Judges, and you cannot come across with the idea of God as a vengeful God because God is looking for any possible reason to save an awful people because he doesn't want to destroy them. He does love them. He seeks to provide for them. And that should kind of put to death this idea of a light switch salvation religion that sometimes we can be tempted to have.
Yeah. Two quick things, actually. We've got a little time crunch here because we've got to close it out here. So I'm going to quick make reference to our last question, which is what is God teaching us or me in these stories? And I'll just tell you straight up, he's teaching us to trust him rather than ourselves is one of the things that's really important. Because whenever we trust ourselves, we basically end up in the dumpster fire. We are throwing gasoline on the problem.
Yeah.
That's a challenge for all of us, a big challenge. And Judges shows us that. He shows us some deep spiritual needs that can be satisfied in God are only temporarily salved in the world's other options because things go bad. Edwin's comment of, you know, do what is right in the eyes of God, not what is right in my eyes, is abundantly clear in Judges. Jared, thanks for being part of the study today. I'm sure if folks are able to join us Wednesday night, we've got some great stuff to cover in the first chunks of Joshua. We're going to be roughly following, by the way, the outline as presented in Kenneth Way's book, because it's pretty consistent. It's a standard outline to break out the text. And I recommend getting it. It's a good book. I use it to teach Judges from. I always read a commentary along when I teach a class. I don't know if other people do that. And it's a good one. It's not deeply challenging in the sense of you need to know a lot of other things to understand what he's saying. He's written it at what we call popular level. But he gives good citations, good resources, good insight. And so that's something valuable to get. So the feed's going to drop off for a little bit. For those who are part of the Eastside congregation who are interested, Michael West and I will be doing an exhortation at 11 o'clock. But thanks. And Terry is a commentary. I had to comment that. Thanks, Jared. Thanks, everybody. Have a fantastic day.
Look forward to seeing you all on Wednesday.
Yep.